Hey,
you're listening to Avid Research.
Avid Research.
Avid Research.
An Australian STEM podcast.
Where we answer the questions you never quite got around to asking.
Welcome back to the show, team. My name's Amelia, and today, once again, we have a very cool guest on the show. We have newly minted Dr. Ellie. Welcome to the show, Ellie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Now, my understanding is you're an evolutionary biologist, which obviously is like quite a broad potential title. So I'm really curious where this is going to go. So what is your job?
Thank you. So yeah, I've just finished my PhD. We're broadly done in evolutionary biology, but specifically for my PhD, I actually looked at broad scale patterns of speciation and trait evolution in birds. So I'm really interested in a topic called macroevolution, which is broad-scale evolutionary processes that occur between species. So I'm really interested in broad-scale patterns such as how species and their traits are structured in the environment, and also how that causes speciation.
Are you able to explain what speciation is?
Yeah, of course. So speciation is the process that is the formation of new species. And essentially, it's the underlying process that produces all of Earth's biodiversity. And so lots of people are really interested in speciation because across the globe, there's lots of different species, but there's also some groups of species have a lot more than other groups. And so lots of people are interested in why. And so I was really interested in birds, and that's what my PhD focused on. And in particular, I focused on a group of species called the honey eaters, which are Australia's most diverse bird clade. So they range throughout Australia, the South Pacific, Indonesia, and there's also a couple of species in New Zealand. But they're a really interesting group to study speciation in because they're a nice monophyletic clade. So that means they're all related to each other. So you can look at the whole group together. And there's about 190 species, which is quite a nice sample size to look at some really cool questions. Also, they're just a really cool group of birds. They're really pretty. They range from cute little birds such as the eastern spinebill, which some people see feeding on flowers around Australia, and other unknown species such as the scarlet honeyeater. But they also include other species such as friar birds, which are really, really large in comparison and not as cute looking.
That was going to be my first thing is like, oh, they're the pretty birds. Obviously, there's a lot more to science than just like pretty birds. But
no, it helps. It's interesting to study when they're pretty and cute.
Yeah. And you can have pictures of them on your office walls and all that sort of thing. So the formation of new species, I guess I've always thought is as a result of, I guess, the species being spread out physically and them like diverging. I guess like the divergent branches. But when I think about that in relation to birds, birds can fly. It's not like a wombat, which might like get stuck in a valley or something. So how does it work with birds?
So there are lots of different modes of speciation. So ways that species can arise. And so one of the most common modes of speciation is essentially what you described, which is a geographic speciation, where often species will form that have been spread over large geographic distance and they become isolated, or there'll be certain aspects of their range that may change and you can get local adaptation, and then over time that can result in speciation. But it can occur in a lot of different processes. So in plants you can get a lot of sympatric speciation, where species form, new species will arise in the same geographic location. But in birds it's a bit different. There's a lot of processes acting. And so what you brought up about like dispersal ability, that was actually one of the factors I looked at. So one of the first chapters of my PhD, I looked at the relationship between a species' geographic range size and speciation probability in honey eaters. And so that was really interesting because they range across Australia, which is a massive continent, but then also throughout the South Pacific and lots of like really small offshore islands. And so something I actually looked at was dispersal ability and how that's linked with range size and then also speciation likelihood. And I actually found that greater dispersal ability actually promoted speciation, but that was more likely through dispersing to offshore islands, because there's a lot of processes that interact here. So often when species disperse to an island, they don't usually recolonize the mainland. And so they'll go to an island and a few species will live there, and there's a restriction in gene flow and other processes that could be occurring. And that can result in speciation. And so that was actually a really key factor in the honey eaters, was dispersal, and in particular the islands, which caused a lot of speciation. And there's a lot of island endemic species of honey eaters. So there's a lot of species that will live on a single island and are only found on that island. And that's from some of those underlying processes. Of course, there's also a lot more going on. And something else I also looked into was song evolution and how that particularly play a role in speciation. Because I had a similar thought to what you did, Amelia. I thought, oh, birds move around. Typically, you would expect if there's lots of movement, you'd have increased gene flow and lack of speciation. And so that's where I thought, oh, they've got really good dispersal ability. There must be something else going on. And I hypothesized that to be song. So I thought perhaps there were some changes in song because male birds sing to attract females. And species recognition is a really important part of mating and reproduction, and that all plays a role in species divergence and speciation. So I thought song could be playing a role, and that was one of the things I looked into as well.
Was it?
No. Oh. The short answer is no. Not on a macroevolutionary scale. So song is really interesting, and I looked at, so the second chapter from my thesis, I looked at the underlying factors which influence song evolution in honey eaters. So I looked at environment and morphological traits such as body size and beak shape and how that influences song in this group. And then finally, I looked at the relationship between song and speciation. But on that macroevolutionary scale, I couldn't find any evidence for song evolution being linked with speciation. It's definitely a factor which plays a role in sister species, and there's been a range of studies that have looked at it on finer scale. So, for example, a classic example is Darwin's finches. So there was long-term studies where they found that over time there were changes in beak shapes due to mainly dietary preferences, but those beak shapes also caused changes to song repertoires and the sounds that the birds were able to produce, and that played a role in speciation within Darwin's finches. But it turns out that on broader scale, so that's within a few species, a handful of species, but on broader scale, so I looked at the honey eaters, which is about 190 species, it just doesn't seem to be enough of an effect. And that's likely due to the other factors playing a role in speciation in this group. I already mentioned that islands were really important and dispersal. So it's just there's a lot going on. And on that broader scale, the effects of song evolution just didn't seem to be strong enough to actually impact speciation.
I cannot imagine how complicated the statistics were that you needed to do to like get this information out.
Yep, there was a lot of coding, a lot of Bayesian stats, a lot of phylogenetics, a lot of using R and command line and different scripts, and a lot of bashing my head against a computer.
That's where you're going wrong. You're supposed to bash the computer against the desk. Yeah. It's not your fault. I am realizing a significant gap in my knowledge right now. I don't think I fully understand what a species is.
Okay, so typically we follow... That's actually a really good question, and that in itself is a whole potential hole to fold it in. But basically, there are many ways to define a species. The most typical understanding is the biological species concept, which defines species as a group of individuals able to reproduce and produce fertile offspring. But there are a lot of different species concepts, and often we define species based on a range of factors. So there'll be morphological traits. With birds, they always seem to look at song as well. And then also other factors such as genetic data as well. But essentially, yeah, a species is, yeah, a group of individuals that can all able to reproduce and produce fertile offspring.
Okay. And this might be an unfair question, but where do breeds fit in? Like, I'm specifically thinking about dogs. Like, do other types of animals have breeds?
So with breeds with dogs, that's a really human-induced factor through selective breeding, where they've taken... So dogs are all one species. They can technically all breed with each other and produce fertile offspring, but it's just the fact that over hundreds or potentially thousands of years, humans have selectively bred for certain traits, and that's how we've got the breeds. But typically, that, as far as I'm aware, or definitely within... the birds I've looked at, there's not really anything like that. There will be subspecies and there is variation, and often sometimes you do get it where I know in fish sometimes there will be species which are technically able to reproduce and produce fertile offsprings, but they're really morphologically distinct and dissimilar, and so they may be classified as different species. But no, we don't, it's not typically breeds as such, it's more like subspecies. And yeah, the idea of breeds in dogs, that's more of a human induced factor and doesn't quite naturally occur.
That makes sense. It sounds like a lot of these birds are living in very nice places. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about like tropical islands, did you get to go and visit them?
No. So I started my PhD in 2019. And so I just got a year in and just passed my confirmation, and then COVID hit. So I did most of my PhD at home during COVID, but also my work was designed, it was a computer-based project. So there's a lot of existing data out there that can be used. So I relied a lot on publicly available databases and a lot of citizen science databases as well. So to determine where these species are, I used databases such as like eBird and essentially similar to places like iNaturalist. And also for my song data, I used an online database where people upload recordings and then they're checked by experts. And that's the thing, there's a lot of great data online that you can use and incorporate into models and ask really interesting questions with. But yeah, unfortunately, I know I didn't get out to see any birds, but I do go birding here and there on my weekends, and I've explored a fair amount of Victoria and some of Australia to try and find these honey eaters. But oh man, I wish I could have gone to some of those offshore tropical islands or New Guinea or something, but unfortunately that was just not within the scope of the project.
That's fair. Although I do know people who choose PhD projects around travel.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Like, I do love hearing about citizen science data being used. I just think it's so awesome that, you know, I think it's easy to get a bit disenfranchised about uploading things, and it's just so awesome. It's actually
no, it's so important. There's a lot of long-term monitoring programs that rely on citizen science, and no, it's so important. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of apps such as iNaturalist, and I always make an effort to do recordings myself when I'm out and upload them to citizen science databases, because I've used them myself and I know heaps of people that rely a lot on that sort of data.
How does the song analysis work?
Oh, that's a good question. So basically I, for my song data, so I went through hundreds of recordings. So I went through and visualize these songs. So you can visualize them in spectrograms where you can kind of see the notes, and basically to try and look at song, because it's a complicated trait to look at and it's not a usual morphological trait such as like body size or beak shape and size that you can just measure. So I used recordings from databases and visualized them, and I extracted some traits which have commonly been looked at for song from past studies. So one of them, the main important feature I looked at, was just peak frequency. So that's just the frequency throughout the song in which the most sound energy was produced. And peak frequency is thought to be really important for transmission and reception of signals. And birds will sing at different frequencies, and it's thought to be a key factor with species identification for the birds. So that was one of the features I looked at. And then I also looked at maximum and minimum frequency. So I looked at a song and the maximum frequency of the highest pitched note, and then took the minimum frequency of the lowest pitched note. And then from there, I also had a measure of bandwidth, which is the difference between maximum and minimum, to give an indication of how much potential variation there could be in songs. And then lastly, I also looked at song pace, so how fast or slow birds sing. And so for that, I looked at song duration and then the number of notes over duration to give an indication for pace. So just from those five variables was enough to kind of determine differences between species, because again, we've got to remember that this is on a macro scale, so it's very broad scale. So I just needed variables that could kind of capture the species level differences. There's, if you're looking within a single species, you could look at a lot more detailed information about song, like certain dialects or repertoires or song types. But that wasn't the aim of my study. So I just had, yeah, those five really general song variables, which helped capture the differences between species.
That's fascinating. Like, it's very easy to listen to a bird and just be like, oh, that's pretty. But like, there's so much more behind it.
Yeah, and Australian birds are weird too. So they're really loud. That's something, like, if you think of typical songbirds, you think of, you know, nice little sounds. But then in Australia, you've got birds that just screech. One of the honey eaters that included is wattle birds. So in particular, the little wattle bird and all the wattle birds. But I think when I was doing my research, I found there were some quotes describing some of these bird sounds from John Gould, who did a lot of original, looked at birds in Australia. And I think there was a quote where he described the little wattle bird as sounding like a person vomiting.
Oh, that's brutal. We have much worse birds. They're, you know, cockatoos.
Yeah. But even within the songbirds, they're still loud and have these screeches and aren't as harmonic as some of the typical songbirds you'd expect.
Sort of feel like our birds are being judged right now.
No, they're amazing, but like, that's the thing I wanted to look at. Why are Australian birds so loud? Is it something about the environment? Like, yeah.
Is there a lot of background noise, or like, I don't know, they need to cover bigger distances with the sound?
Yeah, so something I looked at when I looked at the underlying drivers of song was I looked at how habitat type can impact song evolution. And so there's the idea that if birds live in a closed or forested area, their sounds don't transmit as well because forests are dense and they absorb the sounds. So it's understood that lower frequency sounds actually transmit further than high frequency sounds. So therefore, based on that, it's expected that birds living in closed or forested environments will produce lower frequency sounds to enable that transmission. And so that was one of the hypotheses I tested for that. But again, I didn't find a strong effect of that having an influence at a macroevolutionary scale. But that is something that has been shown to play a role within species. They've found that some of the species that, or some of the individuals that live in forested areas will produce lower frequency sounds compared to their counterparts that live in open environments. And so Australia is a really weird continent where we've got this massive arid center. And so I think it's just been a combination of the harsh environment and the evolution and the fact that Australia was isolated. You've just got these really cool birds. And that's the thing, like the honey eaters, they've evolved completely separately to other bird groups in the Northern Hemisphere. So they originated in Australia and have dispersed out towards the Pacific. And so that's where honey eaters are really interesting, because they're just this nice isolated group that can be looked at and are only found within Australasia.
It's interesting hearing you talk, because it sounds like the micro, or like the between peers within a species, is like quite different to the macro. Like, it's not necessarily something that you find in a micro situation will be reflected in a macro.
Yeah. So that's something I've definitely been interested in. And I've been interested in kind of seeing how, whether or not these microevolutionary processes, which we know occur within like sister species or within a group of individuals, can actually scale up and have those macroevolutionary consequences. And in some cases it does, but in other cases less so. And that's just how biology works, I guess.
Interesting, but occasionally frustrating, I assume.
Yeah, well, it's all part of it. And we're just, you know, it's all interesting to look at and try and figure out. And it all helps to provide insight into what processes do actually structure biodiversity at larger scales. And like, some things do seem to scale up and have impacts. But yeah, it's just part of doing it. But also perhaps to see, we're unsure that whether or not it means that there is nothing going on at that scale, or you need to just look at it in different groups, or for example, look at all birds globally. Like perhaps if you looked at all birds together in a single analysis, you could see an influence of song impacting speciation. And perhaps I'm not seeing it because I've only got this clade of 200 species. But also in saying that, yeah, it just seems that just some of these things don't seem to scale up.
Mm-hmm. Would it be possible to do a global study? Like that, I assume, would be an unimaginable amount of data.
No, it's possible. So there's only about 10,000 birds globally, which is a decent amount, but it's not a huge amount of species compared to other groups of organisms. So it's definitely possible, and there's global bird databases. What we're really lacking is a solid global bird phylogeny. So especially look at evolution, you want the phylogeny underlying a lot of the analysis, which is the phylogenetic tree showing the evolutionary relationships between species. And so there is a global tree available, but that was last done, I think, in 2012 or 2014. So it's a little outdated, and we've had a lot more. There's been a lot more studies done since then, and lots of the relationships have changed. So that's kind of what we're lacking. But otherwise, like a lot of it's there and you can do it. But someone also needs to go out and get all the song data for all the species. Which I think there was a global study that did look at peak frequency in passerine birds. But otherwise, yeah, there has been some stuff done. But yeah, I think it could be due for a reassessment with a really good quality phylogeny, I think.
That'd also be fascinating. What did your average day look like while you were doing your PhD?
So a day would vary a lot depending on what I was doing. And that's the awesome thing about doing a PhD is you essentially just get to do what you want. You get to choose your research, you get to choose how you're going to do it. And so a normal day would vary a lot from either doing analysis. So some days I would be coding away and trying to get models to run and converge and work. And so it would just be sitting all day playing around with scripts and code. Or other times it would be writing up my findings. So a really important part of doing science is also publishing and communicating the findings. And especially doing a PhD, you have to write a thesis. So writing is a very big part of it. And there's also other aspects that come into that. So data visualization as well. I really enjoy getting to be creative with data visualization in science. And I have a lot of fun making all the figures for my papers. And so many aspects of my job would be producing different outputs and visualizing what my findings and then creating figures out of that for publications. And so, yeah, those are kind of essentially the main things is like, yeah, writing, working on analysis or compiling data, and then, yeah, finding ways to show all those findings.
Do you have a particular like graph or data viz thing that you put together that you're particularly proud of?
So something I am really proud of is essentially, so I love to draw and paint, and I always, I grew up doing a lot of art and stuff, and it's something I hadn't done for many years, but during my PhD, I started drawing and painting honey eaters. And so that was a part I was really proud of because I was able to include a huge range of my illustrations in my figures and throughout my thesis. And that's something that, yeah, I was probably the most proud of regarding the visual aspect and all the figures. So in all my papers and stuff online, especially from my PhD, I've got all my illustrations and the figures and stuff, which is really nice and quite cool to see. And also because they're birds that are beautiful and stuff, so it's lovely having the pictures of the birds, and then it's just extra meaningful because I actually produce those myself.
That is so cool. How many PhD students have art in their own art in their thesis? That is awesome.
Thank you.
That has to help with making it like feel more real for someone reading it. Like they're going to connect with your work more, surely.
Oh, yeah. And like also just who doesn't love a pretty picture? I always like reading stuff that has nice visual components to it. And yeah, I think it helps a lot. And I think the visual side of things is really important for science communication as well. You see more and more these days where when people publish a paper, they'll do either a graphical abstract or a video abstract, or sometimes people create videos to advertise their papers. But also, along with that, you also see a range of like infographics and design pieces. And so I really enjoyed that part of it. And that was something I loved about doing my PhD, was having the freedom to explore those different aspects and be able to have my own creative input and just kind of play around with things and have a go, because that's what a PhD is about.
And you're going to have developed some very useful skills, I suspect, in that like playful process.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I learned a lot from just playing around and trying things out during my PhD.
And working out what doesn't work.
Yes, that was a big part of it.
How did you end up doing that work? Like, what was your plan from high school to now?
That's a great question. Basically, I always knew I wanted to do science and research. And I definitely, throughout high school, I really developed a love for science. And I just knew I wanted to go to uni and study science. And I knew I always wanted to just do research. I didn't have a particular topic. I wasn't like, I love birds and I want to work on birds. It was just, I love science and I want to do anything with science. So when I started uni, I think my major was originally chemistry, but I was also doing a range of zoology papers, and I just loved zoology and I loved evolution. I loved this idea of adaptation, how species can change over time, and you know, all those key ideas from Darwin, like natural selection, survival of the fittest. And that was what I wanted to study. And so, yes, I went to uni and did that. And I did an honours where I looked at coevolution between crabs and their parasites, actually. And that's when I first got introduced into phylogenetics and loved it. And then from there, I had an opportunity to work as a research assistant in that same lab where I looked at what potentially drives parasite speciation. So it's a macroevolutionary study. And that's when I really thought I really enjoyed just phylogenetic analysis and macroevolution. And that's what I wanted to do. And so I looked for a PhD position and, yeah, got in contact with potential supervisors and found someone willing to take me on and kind of developed a project from there. So the funny thing is, with my PhD, the project I'm doing isn't actually what I applied for. So I originally actually applied for a subantarctic biogeography PhD, looking at just, yeah, biogeographic processes in the subantarctic and phylogenetics thrown in there too. But due to a range of factors, that didn't quite work out. And so I turned up to do my PhD and my supervisor was like, well, what do you want to do? And so I said, well, actually, I'm really interested in macroevolution and speciation. And the great thing about my supervisor is, any idea I've mentioned to him, he's like, great, go do it. Like, he's just like, go do it. And I'm like, okay. And so he was just like, yep, we'll make it work. We found a great co-supervisor who knew all the analytical skills, which was really important. And yeah, I kind of ended up working on honey eaters because they were just a great clade to focus at, to look at the questions I wanted to ask. And that's just kind of how it happened. So I didn't actually purposely want to study birds. I just kind of fell into it because they were a great model system to answer the questions I wanted to ask and had the data available. And so, yeah, that's kind of how it happened.
Because I was going to ask if you were like a bird person first or a computer person first. It doesn't sound like either.
Yeah, probably in that regard, more of a computer person. So I love the methods and all that kind of stuff. And so that's what I said when I started my PhD. I'm like, well, I said to my supervisor, I'm not really a systems person. I'm more of a methods person. I was just like, I love learning these methods and doing anything involving macroevolution, phylogenetic comparative methods. And I was just like, I want to learn as much as I can. And so, and that's the thing about like the methods and stuff is that I can actually apply them to any system.
That is kind of cool, because it's sort of like wandering around with a key that you can unlock so many different doors with.
Yeah, or just even it means like some of the questions I've looked at and answered using honey eaters, I can look at in different groups. So I don't know, I could look at some of these same questions in other species like mammals or, you know, anything. But it's really interesting.
It's a bit of a step away from the crabs with their parasites, though. was that an interesting project to work on?
Yeah, it was great. I loved it. So yeah, that was with my honours. So I was at the University of Otago and I was working with a lab group where the lab group focused on evolutionary ecology of parasites. And yeah, it was just a little honours project where this was in New Zealand. So I collected parasites. I collected crabs from the shoreline, right, like along the South Island, and looked at their parasites. And I looked at both the genetics of the crabs and the other parasites, and I also compared it to look at if there was any potential co-evolutionary relationships going on, because parasites, the unique thing about parasites is that they rely heavily on their hosts. Their hosts are essentially how they disperse and their ranges and stuff like that. And so it may seem like it's quite different from what I ended up doing for my PhD, but a lot of the same ideas actually crossed over. So I looked at how, especially later when I looked at parasite speciation, I looked at how hosts can influence speciation. For a parasite, a host could essentially be their range. And so for like my PhD research, I looked at the relationship between range size and speciation, which I thought was all similar ideas, essentially.
That sounds like a fascinating project as well.
Yeah.
When did you start to pick up like the coding skills that you needed?
So the coding side of things is a very key part of science. And so definitely throughout my undergraduate, I was exposed to it a little. So I did a couple of stats courses. That was a requirement for doing a zoology degree, was that you need actually a bit of a statistical background. And so, yeah, I learned a bit through that. But then essentially it was just by doing it. And yeah, so I learned a lot throughout my honours and working as a research assistant. But otherwise I was just thrown into the deep end for my PhD and just learned it. And I do as anyone does when they code. I Google half the things, copy and paste code, and then try and see if it works. And yeah, there for some of the things I did, there was great tutorials available online. But otherwise, yeah, just kind of learned it. But that's where I had a co-supervisor that also knew a lot of the analytical approaches. So he was able to help me to some extent and at least guide me to the right areas. But a lot of it, and depending what you do, but some of the stuff I would do, I'd complain that I couldn't find any resources for it online. And then I'd actually have my co-supervisor remind me. He's like, that's because this hasn't been done before. And so like, I'd be building on past work, of course, but a lot of it with science is sometimes if you're doing more novel things, is sometimes people haven't applied the same analysis in that exact way before. And so there are a lot of new things and it's a lot of trial and error and learning. But yeah, it was definitely, for the coding skills, it's definitely just been a process over a number of years.
Yeah, that is kind of awesome though, during like being one of the first people to do something.
To some extent, it's only like in little ways here and there. But no, it's always fun. It's always nice trying new things and seeing if we can use existing analyses in like a different way. That's always fun. And it's nice to get creative and think outside the box for those sorts of things.
Have you got any advice for past Ellie?
I don't know, just be to just go with the flow. So something I've been guilty of is always trying to plan things. And as I've learned from doing a PhD and doing one and throughout a pandemic, is that nothing goes to plan. So my advice to my past self would just be to just not stress so much and just go with the flow and just to hope that it's all going to work out. Because, yeah, there were a lot of changes and a lot of things going on, which is all very stressful. And I'm the type of person that I love to have a solid plan and I love to stick to that plan. But, yeah, you need to learn not to do that and not to worry about that either.
Yeah, that whole being able to accept change and then pivot and...
Yeah, I got very good at pivoting throughout my PhD. I think anyone that's done a PhD in these last few years, just with COVID, like everyone has been affected to some extent. And I was fortunate that my project was already computer-based prior to the pandemic, but I know lots of people had to shift to doing computer-based projects and things like that. So yeah, I think that's going to be a skill that a lot of PhD students will have coming out of this period.
And that's valuable, like life skill.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's some good advice. Be, adaptive and flexible.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any particular myths or misconceptions And yeah, you can take this as broadly as you like, that you'd like to take this opportunity to do some myth busting.
So I guess the main one I can think of is the misconception about, to do science, you either need to be out in the field or wearing a lab coat. So that's a very common thing. And even you see it all the time when people do media interviews, they'll still get the people that are computer-based scientists to go to a lab and put on a lab coat for a quick photo that they can put in, whatever. But yeah, so much science is just done behind a computer, and there's so much data available online that you can ask a huge range of questions. And I think that's awesome, because getting out to a lab or to a field is also costly financially and time-wise. And so it's amazing that there's all this data online that you can readily use and look at really cool questions with. And so, yeah, that's a really common misconception, is that, yeah, to do good science, you either need to be in a lab or out in the field, when you can actually just have a computer.
There's an accessibility aspect to that as well. Like, you can do good science like working from home or with other constraints on your life. You don't have to be going to Antarctica for 6 months or something necessarily. Yes.
But there's definitely also, like, you can, amazing things you get out of field work, which you just can't at home. But this day and age, it's just not always necessary, and you don't need that.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a while for the white lab coat photo op to die. Like,
yeah, I think so.
That's a good one. That's a good one. So have you got a shout out for us, or a virtual high five for someone or someone you think is just doing an awesome job?
Oh, I wasn't prepared for this part. Can I just talk to all women in STEM?
Totally.
Yeah, I think all women in science. So I'm a big advocate for women in science. I think any woman doing science right now is doing an amazing job, and that's who I'd like to give a shout out to. No offense to women doing science, you're also doing a good job, but just women in particular.
Yeah, the men have had plenty of shout outs in the past.
Yeah.
So 100% high five to all the women in science and in STEM, really. Yeah, it can be tough, but the world is improved by you doing the work that you're doing.
Yeah, and we need everyone doing it to also keep going and keep staying in academia, because I think it's really important. And we still, even though we've come a long way, I still think we've got a long way to go. And I think more women in science will help. It'd be better.
Definitely. I like it. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Ellie. It has been absolutely delightful, and I have even more appreciation for all the birds. So thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please pass it on to someone else who you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to support Avid Research this year, that would be amazing. You can buy us a coffee, head to avidresearch.com.au, and there'll be a link, buy me a coffee, and you can support us with a one-off little coffee payment. Thanks so much for listening. You're a legend.